Prior to capitalism, the way people amassed great wealth was by looting, plundering, and enslaving their fellow man. Capitalism made it possible to become wealthy by serving your fellow man. Welcome to Keith Knight, Don't Tread on Anyone in the Libertarian Institute. Today, I'm joined by Marcel Gautreau, a PhD student at George Mason University and a Mises Institute research fellow. Mr. Gautreau, thank you for your time. Where's the best place to find your collection of research?
My collection, I don't have a personal website yet. So for those who want to just engage with my content, we'll say you can follow me on Twitter at Anarchy in Black, and I have a Substack. I've yet to put out, you know, a personal website, although I should at this point in my studies have one. So for now, just follow me on Twitter, which is just at Anarchy in Black. Also, just a minor point of correction before we move forward. My last name is pronounced Gautreau, like that, not Gautreau.
Oh, Gautreau. I was going to pride myself everybody. On getting it right. I thought I heard it correctly before.
Yeah, don't worry about it at all. But yeah, I just wanted to get that straight. But yeah, I'm glad to be here. Thanks for having me on.
Of course. Links to Marcel's research
Twitter
and everything, Twitter and Substack, will be in the description below. Marcel, what is public choice theory?
Public choice theory, you could also call it non-market decision-making, is really just the study of, you know, how economics or economizing decisions are made primarily in the context of government and bureaucracy, but you can apply public choice theory to a lot of other contexts. So Peter Leeson famously applies public choice theory to pirates and churches.
What is praxeology and why is it important?
So praxeology is, okay, literally the study of action. It is a theory and method of Austrian economics. It is the way in which we view economics, starting from first principles to its ultimate micro foundation, as viewing economics as the result of individuals economizing or individuals acting in a world of scarcity under uncertainty.
Now, what do you think are some of the limits of empiricism? For example, when asked about should we have certain regulations or antitrust or minimum wage? A lot of people will say, well, let's pile up the studies, read through them, and come to a conclusion based on the consensus. People like Walter Block would say, no need for the studies. We have this praxeological approach to things. What are some of the limits of empiricism that should make us skeptical about trusting the experts as far as economics goes?
Ultimately, when working with empirical data, which I'm not entirely opposed to, but, you know, anybody in the end can say almost anything they want by messing with data enough. And when it's weird. One of the things you can say as a joke, but you can't say as like a serious criticism. But any academic knows what p-hacking is, right? Any academic knows what cherry picking sources is. Everybody understands, and we all laugh with each other about, you know, just continually tweaking a paper until you get a publishable result. And especially within our own fields, economists know all about this, but somehow when we take this thing that we all know, we all agree is true and funny, and then we say, okay, I have a serious problem with the way that all science is done, especially in the social sciences, then suddenly this is seen as like a strange, like you're seen as almost like a Neanderthal who's going around trying to word trick, to almost mind trick people with syllogisms. Right. And that's like a common criticism of libertarianism, of course, that we rely on these syllogisms to get what we want. But, you know, if you want to challenge a syllogism, challenge a syllogism.
But of course, they never apply that to themselves. They'll always say things like homophobia is inherently bad, colonialism inherently bad. We don't need to run any experiments. We just know that these things are inherently bad. Well, what happened to having to run the experiments and measure GDP and see how inequality is affected as a causal result of colonial homophobia? They have the highest standards for us, but no standards for themselves.
Or even simple, you know, when somebody says, you know, I say something is true and then you have a study to back that up. It's like, do you have a study that shows that you require studies to reach accurate conclusions?
Yeah, that was great. I think it was in a book by Steven Pinker where he goes, studies show that studies don't show much at all. A lot of studies show that a lot of research cannot be reproduced and is not done properly with the scientific method. So yeah, great answer to that one. What is your favorite book or essay on praxeology or a level one introductory to economics?
Level one intro to economics. So I'll just say, you know, this is a bit of an Austrian heresy, but my first introduction to economics was actually Economic Facts and Fallacies by Thomas Sowell, who's not an Austrian, he's a Chicagoan. If somebody were to tell me, you know, what's like a, I just say economics in one lesson. You know, what is a level one book to give somebody? There you go.
So Thomas Sowell defines, I want to get this right. He says economics is the study.
I love the copy. That's great.
Economics is the study of the use of scarce resources, which have alternative uses. Do you agree with that definition?
Reader, for me one more time.
Economics is the study of the use of scarce resources, which have alternative uses.
I would say it's a study of the exchange of scarce resources, not the use of scarce resources. If somebody says the study of the use of scarce resources, I would say it's like industrial organization or something, right? It's, economics is about the exchange between people.
But otherwise, I'm sorry to interrupt you.
Otherwise, it's a pretty solid definition. You know, economics is a study of something, 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 scarce resources, and I would just say exchange and not necessarily use.
Does Robinson Crusoe on the island by himself
have an economy
by himself?
Now.
He doesn't have an economy. Does he face the issue of economizing his scarce time and access to goods?
Oh, I see. Yes, I suppose he does. And actually, now I'm thinking about it even further. If we go back to what economics literally means, it's household management. And so Robinson Crusoe also definitely has a household himself to manage. So, okay, we might use a colloquial term, economizing, right? Making the most out of the least. To Robinson Crusoe, although I would still say Robinson Crusoe may have, okay, Robinson Crusoe has to economize in that sense, but he does not have an economy. And the study of Robinson Crusoe, I would strongly object to calling economics.
Got it. Sowell says, without scarcity, there is no need to economize. Do you agree that scarcity is at the heart of economic decision making?
Yes.
Yes. The reason...
There are some, yes, because I'm trying to think of certain things that aren't, like things like, you know, status. But even then, you could say that's not economics, that's political decision making. So yes, if there were no scarcity, studying economics would be almost completely pointless. Yeah.
The reason I bring up scarcity multiple times is because we always hear from politicians that this scarcity almost doesn't exist. We have things that can be free. They're just one law away, and then everyone has them. The police are free. The military is free. Healthcare and education can be free, and there's no downside. I see this almost as like the biggest propaganda ploy that scarcity doesn't exist, and therefore we can have all these things so long as we give the state enough power to redistribute them. Does it seem like we're always called, you know, unrealistic and living pie in the sky? Meanwhile, we're the only ones that recognize the importance of scarcity living in the real world. Do you think this is an advantage that libertarians have as far as seeing things as they really are?
Yes, in the sense of realizing that material scarcity is real, but it's a very strange sort of advantage to have, in that our advantage is sort of a basic observation of reality. But in this case, I think it's similar to what I was saying before about, you know, academics sort of implicitly understanding, you know, how you can mess around with empirics until you actually say it out loud. You know, every person walking around today, you know, except for like a few committed weirdos in Brooklyn, understands that we live in a world of material scarcity. But once you start building a political position out of this obvious this observation, then suddenly we have a problem here.
How do you think it's gotten to the point where people almost see the state as magic? Like, well, when someone tells me houses should be free, or, you know, it's wrong to exclude anyone, I just put the burden on them. I say, you need to build me a house. You say people don't respond to incentives. You have a house for yourself, but you've built me zero houses. I mean, either people are self-interested or they're not. Anytime you try and bring this idea of statism into any other realm of people's life, they see it as totally immoral and ridiculous. How do you think this trick has been played on, 7 billion people?
So funny enough, I remember... Deirdre McCloskey, I don't remember exactly in which book or what pamphlet, but it was something that I'd read that she had written where she talks about how urbanization was part of the problem here. She was giving an anecdote about a professor who was teaching economics in some, in the early 20th century to people who had grown up on farms, and was saying how they all just implicitly got the ideas of supply and demand, because to them, you know, just the idea of price changes, of, you know, changing the market fundamentals were just a natural part of their everyday lives. But then once you move into cities and you sort of engage in this higher standard of living and you become more and more specialized, you know, the economy ceases to be in your mind implicitly something real and just sort of becomes, you know, something that changes and maybe affects the employment numbers, right? And so as America becomes more urban and becomes, I really despise the term separated from the reality, but becomes more abstracted from, becomes more abstracted from, let's say, direct physical production, the economy becomes more of an abstraction and more more something that can be played with in the minds of Americans. So I would say the turning point here would have to have been, you know, sometime in the early 20th century.
What is the primary cause of recessions?
Primary cause of recessions in general? I would just say malinvestment. You know, recession happens when, for one reason or another, whether it's credit expansion or just because people, you know, hopped onto a trend, people have invested in things that they shouldn't have in this sort of painful phase of liquidation. So yes, what is the cause of recession? People making mistakes in what they choose to invest in, and then the realization of the mistake, the correction of that mistake, is what we call the recession.
And would you say that there's any, you know, main culprit when it comes to recessions, whether it's Wall Street or investors or the Federal Reserve or the ignorant consumers?
In our present context, most recessions that we encounter are caused by credit expansion in the Federal Reserve, right? So it's not the only cause of recession, but now that I properly appreciate your question, yes. So the primary causes of recessions, of business cycles, you know, people make mistakes all the time, but it should be very unusual and suspicious to us when we see people making the same kind of mistake all in the same direction for 15 years continuously. And this is, yes, the result of easy money policies by the Federal Reserve, easy access to credit, people just chasing yield and investing in a variety of schemes that they really otherwise would not have and would have had no businesses doing.
Why are some nations wealthy and others impoverished?
Some nations are wealthy and some nations are poor. I would say at the most base level, because of insecure property rights. So I adhere to Smith's admonition that, you know, the only thing you need to bring a nation to from the lowest poverty to the heaps of prosperity are easy taxes, peace, and a Talbot administration of justice. And so for most countries in the world at this point, their biggest problem is tolerable administration of justice. You know, so certain states more than others can protect property rights, but also certain cultures do not protect property rights. And a lot of people don't see this angle, but, you know, every once in a while you'll have countries, especially you see this problem in like sub-Saharan Africa, where you have there's no shortage of people who are entrepreneurial, no shortage of people who are fully capable of running farms or complex businesses, but either because the state predates on them or even their own family see, you know, this, you know, you have an extended family structure and then a single person in it is like the main breadwinner. And the more productive this person becomes, suddenly the wider obligations the extended family become, right? And so, you know, you'll have foreign aid workers come into the country and help this guy irrigate his farm or whatever, and he'll be perfectly capable of operating this. And then at the end of the year, they're like, all right, now you got to save and invest in this next year. And he's like, I actually can't do that. It's like, why? Well, you know, now that I made all this extra money, I am like ethically required by my entire family to hold a feast for them and like squander that money. Otherwise, they'll think that I'm basically the reincarnation of Satan. So there you go. You know, and this is like a culture problem that needs to be fixed. And I would say for most of the world, you know, there hasn't really, we are in a more peaceful world. A lot of these countries don't even have the state capacity to levy onerous taxes. So property protection is the number one obstacle in most of these places.
If I care only about the well-being of the poor, why should I be a libertarian?
Economic development is making more things more available. It is increasing the possibility of options to people. So you should want whatever policy leads to increased development, ultimately. And libertarianism is the policy bundle that leads to the most economic development in the first world and the third.
Massive wealth inequality is bad, therefore forced redistribution is necessary. How do you respond?
actually massive wealth inequality is good because people are different in their endowments, they're different in their skills, they're different in their ability to use resources to benefit others. Wealth inequality is it's a feature of capitalism, not a bug. I'm for it. I'm actually for more inequality. Like, I'm for raising living standards for the bottom, but I actually think that the amount of effort it would take to raise living standards at the bottom would justify raising living standards at the top even more, right? You know, I see Elysium and I think, man, how great is it that we have all of these robots that can cure all diseases? I'm sure glad that the people who invented these get to live on a paradise island in space.
Sure. If you had to really communicate it to someone who sees their paycheck as, you know,
you cut out. I didn't hear anything after sure.
Okay.
The connection dropped. I didn't hear your question.
All right. Is it better now?
Yes.
Okay. If I'm someone who sees that my income is way far below the people like Sam Walton, Andrew Carnegie, John D. Rockefeller, and Jeff Bezos, how do you tell me my paycheck is so much smaller than theirs? How on God's green earth am I possibly benefiting from people that have billions and billions of dollars?
Well, they must have done something to get those billions and billions of dollars, you know, and in some cases, libertarians kind of like to take the easy out and they say, well, you know, the reason they enjoy all this privilege is because of regulations or some kind of government cronyism. And to some extent, that's true in any, you know, any liberal economy. There are people who make their living predating. But these kinds of massive wealth inequalities, I mean, Jeff Bezos, Elon Musk, these people are good at industrial organization. Right? These people are good at delivering services to lots and lots of people, making lots and lots of people's lives incomparably better. So, you know, when you are a small part in that division of labor, you know, you get your paycheck and it may be small, but the fact is that you benefit from all the goods and services embodied by the wealth that is accrued to Jeff Bezos and Elon Musk. I mean, especially when you talk about Jeff Bezos, you know, Jeff Bezos's wealth isn't like, it's just a series of merchant contracts. You know, Jeff Bezos has almost nothing to liquidate. I guess, you know, he has the warehouses and the trucks, but warehouses and trucks, if you really think about that for another second, it really should not be that much wealth. It's really just real estate. Most of it is the fact that Jeff Bezos has a series of agreements with a bunch of merchants and producers into this very efficient supply chain that lets me get almost anything I want within 2 days, right? And so that series of contracts, that is almost pure intellectual capital, right? That is his wealth. And so if somebody were to say, well, I think I should have it, like, you want to repossess Jeff Bezos's contract with the guy that makes lamps? You know what I mean? Because that's what his wealth is.
What are the potential downsides of the state nationalizing all corporations and turning them into democratic worker cooperatives?
Most workers don't know how to manage corporations. If they did, they would be. That would be the biggest problem. As I've pointed out in the case of a lot of American businesses, especially Amazon, you know, Jeff Bezos, it's great because Jeff Bezos is like the richest man in the world, or like trades places with Elon Musk from year to year or whatever. You know, if you try to repossess it, it will just turn to sand in your fingers, right? There's no thing there to take. So, and it would cause, and you'd see quickly how many other things, just from the act of repossession, you'd see how many other things are only valuable because they are secure in their property rights. I mean, most people don't care about these things. Even as I give this answer, I'm thinking about it like, you know, only a libertarian cares about this, since most people that want to repossess from Jeff Bezos and Elon Musk are sort of these spiteful mutants that don't actually want to make people better off. They just want to hurt Jeff Bezos and Elon Musk because, you know, evil, white, male, capitalist, whatever. And so I'd say, you know, hey, if you were to take the thing from them, it wouldn't actually make anybody better off. But that's not really what matters to these people. It's really just taking things from Jeff Bezos and Elon Musk.
I know. It's like the feds have been stealing.
I'm not exactly a Randian, but one thing Rand was 100% right about is like the emotional pathologies that drive these people.
Yeah. Yeah, definitely. I mean, when you point out to them, state's been stealing $5 trillion every year for a while now. How much more is it going to take for you guys to be happy? I mean, it's like $1 trillion a year in entitlements alone. And even when you show them, if you take all the wealth from all the wealthiest people, it's going to cover like 8 months of next year's federal government budget. And even then, if you tell them they're getting more money, they're going to spend more. So it's not even going to be 8 months. But they're not too interested in that.
And less than that even, because again, if you really think about what it means to confiscate Jeff Bezos's wealth, right? It shrinks in your hands, right? It's like putting spinach on a frying pan, right? Mm. So he's like, oh, we just take all Jeff Bezos' wealth, we can finance the government. Like, but really think what you're doing. Are you financing the government with a bunch of merchant contracts and trucks, right? Imagine, again, this kind of requires a person who isn't, this argument only works on somebody engaging in good faith. But, you know, imagine if you lived in a society where everybody has a bunch of stuff and then I have like a rock and it's worth $10. And then somebody says, you know, actually, Marcel, I'd be willing to pay if I had it, or if I could get some friends together, we'd all be willing to pitch in and pay you $10 billion for that rock. And then somebody goes and says, Marcel, you know, if we were to take that rock from you, we can use it to pay for my healthcare. It's like, no, that's not really true, right? Because as soon as you take that rock from me, all the people are going to pitch in for shares in the rocks. Like, well, we only wanted to get shares in that rock because, you know, we could hold on to it. But if we know that people are going to take that rock in any moment, then none of us want it, right? And none of us want to pitch in. So suddenly society has become $10 million poorer. And so now you can't fund the healthcare system with my ordinary stone that I picked up off the ground. And by the way, what I've described to you should also be seen as an indictment of like national income accounting.
Mises said that an increase in real wages is the result of capital investment and increased worker productivity. Would you agree with that?
Yes.
And could you explain that maybe?
Can I elaborate on that?
Yeah. if you could explain that and maybe use like a real world example to bring that theory into practice for us.
Sure. Increased capital. So the end result of all capital investment is consumer benefit, right? At the end, you know, there's this refrain that we have, I think Per Bylund uses it, but almost any Austrian would use it, which is, you know, bread is not valuable because it uses wheat. Wheat is valuable because it is used for bread, right? Any capital investment is used towards the end of making more things available for consumers, you know, obviously at a profit, right? There's a selfish benefit here. And so when I say that a country has had economic development, that just means that more things have been produced. And the way you get increased development is through lengthier production processes, is through increases in technology, is through savings and investment. So yes, the only way that a worker can become better off, and a real wage increase means not just an increase in paper money, but, you know, an increase in the value of that paper money, more things to be done with your paper money, since we're assuming a fiat standard in these kinds of conversations, right, is through increased material production by entrepreneurs.
We need the state to regulate the average person, or else we'll have buildings falling such as that as happened recently in Florida. How do you respond?
There's a building, a thing in Florida? What was this?
Yes. There was
a few months ago, I remember this now.
An apartment complex. Yes.
Yes. Okay. We need the state to regulate buildings. You know, funny enough for that one, I'd just say, show me the data. Like, show me the data on building collapses before we saw all these zoning regulations. But, you know, yes, in theory, I could also just make several arguments just saying, you know, most people don't want to live in falling buildings. If this, like, there is a certain amount of risk that people are willing to bear. You know, if somebody were to say that we want buildings to be as stable as reasonably achievable, which is the standard we use for like nuclear reactors, you know, what you're really saying is, as soon as there's any innovation in technology to make buildings cheaper to make, you know, just keep adding higher and higher regulations on the building until the cost of making the building is enough to cancel out, you know, the decreased price in building materials or whatever. But in fact, we find that most people are not willing to spend infinite amounts of money and do indeed like living in cheaper buildings. So these are just kind of the risks that you engage in economy. But of course, a lot of people say, well, I don't want to engage in that kind of risk, you know, with children who live in the buildings or something like that. But again, these are risks that are economized on by the market. If you actually do manifest that desire, revealed in your preferences by who you purchase from. You know, a lot of buildings are not owned by, you know, individual people, but by, you know, large property developers. We can just start, you know, if it's really that intolerable to you, we can just start changing the market will just start changing the arrangement of who owns buildings and who doesn't, right? You know, if you find that, you know, bearing a certain amount of risk of unstable buildings is intolerable, then fine, BlackRock can own that building and we'll see how BlackRock feels about the level of risk that was involved here. But most of us enjoy decreased consumer costs. You know, people often complain likewise about like planned obsolescence, right? They'll say, you know, in the old days, you know, you had cars made of like, you know, cast iron and you could drop them off the Empire State Building and they would dent the concrete and now they're made of plastic or whatever. And part of that is government regulation. You know, now cars need to have like a 1 billion to 1 crumple zones, but also because people want cheaper cars, right? And I suppose if you want, you can go ahead and, well, no, you can't buy a car made of cast iron because you can't buy, you know, Betamax tapes anymore. Right? People don't want that level of certainness for a car. They want a car that can get more than 3 miles to the gallon. Right. You make a trade-off on fuel economy, you make a trade-off on speed, and you make a trade-off on price. So, you know, if somebody says, oh, we need government regulation to stop buildings from falling down. No, I place a pretty high premium on a building that is not going to fall down in the time scale of me living there. And I'm not interested in paying, you know, twice the price so that my building will last longer than, you know, the United States government will.
Exactly.
Of course, God willing, it will only last for, you know, 3 days from now, right? But you know what I'm saying?
Yeah, as opposed to as if these all these shortcomings, laziness, greed, short-sightedness, as if they don't apply to government officials, as if they don't face the stress of having to economize, as if they don't subject anyone to risk. You know, 90% of their drones kill civilians. The other 10% are fake terrorists. And yeah. And we're so terrified that that there could be an era of voluntary exchange where people have negative externalities. How about the case of antitrust? The argument might go something like, in the absence of a state, you might have some people bullying, intimidating others, acting unscrupulously, gaining a high percentage of an industry. And then once they're in that high position of power, they drastically increase the prices, making consumers and employees worse off. Therefore, antitrust is legitimate. How would you respond to that?
I would say this is fake. This is just totally socialist propaganda made up in the 1920s. This literally never happened. I mean, like, this is a conspiracy theory. It's total horseshit. Sorry, can I curse on this? Is this allowed?
Yeah.
Okay, yeah, it's total fake nonsense. And this idea of like predatory pricing is what we call this. This has, and I can't emphasize this enough, this has never happened ever. Ever. If you look at the, you know, the empirical data, right, we see that the price of oil, you know, because the Standard Oil is the case that's used. And I kind of forget, it wasn't Andrew Carnegie, because Carnegie was a steel magnate. I forget who ran Standard Oil at the time. But yeah, the idea was like, oh, of course, it was Rockefeller. And it's like, oh, you know, Rockefeller, if he finds out you're going to open an oil rig, he will just drop the price of oil down so that you can't do it. You know, if that were true, and some people allegedly did make small fortunes by just, you know, pretending to set up oil refineries just to bait Rockefeller into buying off the assets from them. But in practice, what that just meant was that Rockefeller was just outsourcing the construction of oil refineries, right? Some other entrepreneur just bore all the risk of, you know, getting the capital investment, built up the oil refinery, the oil rig, or what have you, or the oil drill. And then once it was all made, Rockefeller's like, awesome, I'll pay you a lump sum for that. And this was just another, a very strange kind of business model, but that's not predatory pricing. That's just making consumers better off because oil just gets cheaper. If somebody delivers on that threat, they are making oil cheaper for, you know, however long it takes to drive the other guy bankrupt. And of course, we know that we live in a highly capitalized economy. You know, just because you have 10 times somebody's production does not mean that you have 10 times their cash revenue, just because you have 10 times their production doesn't mean you have 10 times their cash reserves. And so if every pay period, you know, they're losing $1, you're losing 10, right? Each time this happens. And unless you have 10 times as much money in the bank as they do, which you definitely don't, because, you know, your investors would never stand for that sort of maneuver. You're going to go bankrupt before they do. And here again, we can just imagine, you know, proposing, if you, the kinds of people who say, you know, nonsense like this have no business being near any industrial organization. If you were to propose this at a board meeting, they think that you were insane. Right. If you said, listen, you know, imagine if you were at McDonald's, you had like a stranglehold on fast food. And then somebody said, you know, hey, listen, we got rumors that there's a new company called Burger King that's about to hit the streets and we don't want that to happen. So I say we start handing out burgers for free until Burger King goes bankrupt. Right. We're like, that's the most ridiculous, asinine suggestion I've ever heard in my entire life. This would fail immediately. How many other objections do I have to this kind of nonsense? Oh, if we also, you know, if we have a free trade environment, especially like, you know, where there's no tariffs in other countries, this kind of regime would also never work. Like, you know, a collusion monopoly regime would also never work, right? Because let's say that you have, you know, all, you know, Standard Oil buys out all the oil in America and has decided not to, decided to raise prices on us. You know, is Standard Oil also going to buy all the oil in Saudi Arabia or all the oil in Venezuela and so on and so forth? Now, as it is, OPEC is a pretty stable cartel because you have one incredibly hegemonic member of the firm, Saudi Arabia, which has, you know, almost as many oil resources as the rest combined. And also you're dealing with nation states and, you're dealing with nation states and treaties and things like this. But even then, we see constantly that the OPEC, give me a second. The OPEC cartel is not as stable as you think. Also, we see the OPEC countries often lobby, you know, domestic governments to not find substitutes towards oil. So some of the largest environmentalist groups in the United States are backed by Saudi oil money, right? So not only, so you have this cartel that it uses not only state power of its members, but state powers of its non-members, right, to keep this cartel stable. This would not be normally possible in an internal free trade environment without antitrust laws.
One final soul quote that I liked from this one is,
sorry, says, if I could just pause to like close this picture. You know, imagine Henry Ford has a monopoly on making cars in America, and then you find that Henry Ford is also like lobbying the French government. Imagine Henry Ford gets a monopoly on cars in America somehow, and he tries to keep the price of Ford cars very high. And then he said, well, what about Italian cars? And, you know, to have Henry Ford be like OPEC in this scenario, you would have Henry Ford paying people in Italy to like lobby the government to make, you know, Maseratis and Ferraris and whatever more and more expensive, right? It's very hard to imagine under normal circumstances, a private corporation lobbying the Italian government to destroy Italian car companies. But thanks to, you know, the insanity of the U.S. government, we do have the Saudi government lobbying directly and indirectly the United States government to be less fuel, to be less energy independent.
What would be a negative downside of the state monopolizing the healthcare industry and declaring all healthcare needs to be free and paid for by increase in printing of the money supply?
Well, okay, that's two. Well, you just said increase in the money supply, so that would just be the price inflation. Also, so there's just the basic, you know, once it's free, people will use it more, and, you know, you have this overuse and rationing. But the biggest one would be just the bureaucratization of the healthcare system, which is already disgusting in this country. But if once it were government controlled, I can only imagine, you know, the amount of layers of bureaucracy that would add to each level. But of course, again, to the kinds of people that want universal healthcare, this bureaucratization is a feature, not a bug, right? You know, neo-nationalism in the present situation, not so much a case in, you know, in the 1950s and 60s where you had like these post-colonial regimes engaging in nationalization. In those cases, they probably really did unironically think that if they can just take the Suez Canal, take British oil, take these things, or take these dams, right, that would make the country richer. I'm sure they earnestly thought that, you know, these but now today, I don't think anybody really thinks that nationalizing the healthcare system would make things better off. But what they think is, man, just think of all my liberal friends that will be able to get hired with their gender studies degrees, you know, doing diversity mandates in a universal healthcare system. Right. That's like the real goal here.
One of my,
so as you tell me, you know, oh, you know, what are the downsides? You know, I'm listing off the downsides, but I'm assuming like I'm talking to a normal person. I'm speaking to it, but this is not going to help you. You know, I'm giving your audience like a meta commentary. You know, here are all the arguments that you can use. But you should be aware that the people that you're arguing with are probably parasites and you don't even need to argue with them at all.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, hey, we're still like Sisyphus pushing that stone up the hill. One of my favorite soul quotes in this book was, in reality, most of the great fortunes in American history have resulted from someone's figuring out how to reduce costs so as to be able to charge lower prices and therefore gain a mass market for the product. Henry Ford did this with automobiles, Rockefeller with oil, Carnegie with steel. Sears, Penny, Walton, and other department chain founders with a variety of products. How have they been able to propagate the lie that capitalism equals greed equals high prices equals poverty?
You know, here again, I have to blame what normally I love so very much, which is urbanization. And since urbanization is part of the process of economic development, you know, this is just kind of an inherent, you know, Marx used to talk about the internal contradictions of capitalism, you know, everybody's competing, you know, competition, somebody wins. And here I'm just thinking about it, you know, internal contradiction of capitalism is that it causes people to move into cities and, you know, have these higher productivity jobs, but then it also, that makes them think stupider and stupider things about economics, right? And so, yeah, this, you know, this cartoon idea of what an entrepreneur does is only kind of possible when you work for, you know, this wage labor position with other people in a wage labor where you get paid a wage and everybody else you know gets paid a wage and all the risk is offset to somebody else who lives in like a different part of town, right? Once you have a class of people that does not really bear risks as the market goes, then you suddenly see the proliferation of these really dumbass ideas.
Business owners pay laborers a wage knowing that they will only pay them as much as they can so they can profit off of them. Therefore, this is a relationship of exploitation and is inherently unjust. How do you respond to that?
You know, the wage earner gets paid up front, right? He gets paid he doesn't bear any risk in the situation. And always the person who bears risk gets a risk premium. You know, the people on payroll, not only do they get paid before stockholders, they get paid before, you know, creditors, right? You know, if you have a firm, you know, so you have a firm and then it has the people who own shares in the company, the people who have lent money to the company and the people who work for the company. You know, you can't imagine a business saying, listen, I'm sorry, I can't make payroll today. I got to pay dividends to the shareholders. I mean, not only is that, you know, blatantly, like, it's illegal and it's unimaginable. That's just not how firms are organized. But even saying, like, listen, I can't make payroll today because I owe Johnny whatever over there, $50 billion. So I got to pay him before I pay the workers. This too is like completely illegal. And even in the absence of like a legal arrangement here, this is just an implicit fact of industrial organization. So workers get all these advantages over the hardworking capitalists that invested the money and all the hardworking creditors that lent the money to finance this operation. Workers get to cut right in the front of the line every other week and say, hold on, before you pay anyone else, before you've sold anything, I don't care what you've sold. I don't care who you know. I don't care who you've met. I don't care what your problems are. I worked 40 hours this week. You have to pay me first, right? And that's why you get pay less, right? In exchange for worker privilege, right? The worker privilege of being paid first, guaranteed, no excuses, you get paid less.
Exactly. And the exploitation doesn't account for all of the businesses that are not profitable and go out of business, or the fact that consumers are exploiting stores that they only go to so they could profit off of their products and services that they want. They don't care about those workers where they shop. So, of course, the exploitation just exhausts me to no end.
There's a paper your audience can read on this. I think it's literally called Marxist and Austrian Class Analysis by Hans Hermann Hoppe, where he just talks about viewing the difference between wage and, you know, a hypothetical higher marginal productivity and saying that difference is an interest premium.
Yeah, I've recorded an audio for that excellent essay. I will put that in the description below. That was one of my favorite papers, just because he starts out by saying, Marx has 5 general claims, by the way, all of them are correct. And I'm like, oh my gosh, what's going on here? And then he just makes the solid case that, yeah, these are all true, so long as the culprit is the state or any aggressor parasite, whether small scale or large scale. That was just so brilliant. I'll definitely put that in the description. Competition in a free market is actually competing to cooperate. You agree with that, and why?
Competing to cooperate. Yes, you are competing to structure the best, you know, the best deals, right? You're competing for the best industrial organizations, division of labor. So yes, you're competing for the most productive forms of social cooperation. So yes, competition is competing to cooperate.
What I got from that was, in response to the competition equals dog eat dog, it's like, well, yes, Red Robin is competing with Olive Garden, but in order for Red Robin to exist in the first place, they have to cooperate with like a million different people to buy the silverware and make the tables and build the furniture and everything else. Do you think the criticism of the free market, it's dog eat dog, is justified? And how could you communicate to someone that it's not that case?
At the free market is dog eat dog. Again, here, if somebody were to say that, I would just sort of nod and say yes, right? That I want a ruthless dog eat dog competition to give me, you know, cheaper food, right? Ruthless dog eat dog competition in the production of goods is actually a very, very good thing. I only want the best, most able, most intelligent, most whatever people, you know, using up scarce resources, using up man hours, using up industrial equipment to make me my cell phone, my computer, you know, the food that gets to my table, right? This is, the economy isn't a game, right? Like, this is real life. You know, there's 7 billion people on earth and we all got to eat tomorrow. And, you know, I'm not here for your feelings here. I mean, there are some people who, you know, try to purchase, you know, fair trade goods. Although, of course, fair trade goods more often than not just means like made in America. But I would say, you know, it's a dog eat dog competition. Like, yeah, I'm trying to live, right? I only want the best people using up scarce resources to make things for me.
What differentiates a good economist from a bad economist?
A good economist, you know, has theories, or a good economist makes statements that are in accordance with reality. So an economist that can make good predictions, an economist that that clarifies things for those who he speaks to instead of obfuscating. So as an economist, you know, my goal in particular, this may not be what every economist wants, but I want, because I want to be an academic, you know, I want economics to be understandable to lay people. I want normal people to have an understanding of how the economy works, because when you have the sort of obfuscation of economic laws through p-hacking or whatever, or other ways of, you know, empirical games, you know, people think that the economy is something abstract, something that is not understandable, something only this mystery cast of academic priests knows how to do. And then they start thinking insane things like that you can start handing out healthcare for free, right? So for me, a good economist is somebody who is a public intellectual and helps people understand that this is not the case. And I'm pretty sure this was kind of Mises' conception, but a good economist is also someone who clarifies rather than obfuscates. But you could say in another sense, a good economist is then one who, you know, gives good advice to the sovereign, right? An economist is one who makes good predictions, makes good policy proposals, things like that. So I would say I'm in the first category, or I want to be in the first category. I want to improve economic literacy of the populace. And I'm sure there are others who want to give good advice to the sovereign. Certainly it's more profitable to give more good advice to the sovereign than it is to educate the masses. Although of course we see that a lot of economists give bad advice to the sovereign, often on purpose.
If I had to paraphrase Henry Hazlitt, I don't have it in front of me. He said something to the extent of economics is the practice of being able to see not only the short-term effects on one group, but the long-term effects on all groups, or secondary consequences on more than the immediate group affected. What does this mean, and why is that important?
Okay, so Hazlitt is sort of doing seen and the unseen. This is actually a very interesting thing for Hazlitt to say, because it kind of does validate the, I'm not going to say Hazlitt was like a bad economist, but that means Hazlitt sort of veers into the, you know, advice to the sovereign style of economics, as opposed to the educating the masses of economics, which again is a perfectly valid role to have. But in this case, you know, most people that are lobbying the sovereign for one policy or another are going to try to get privileges for themselves, and they'll try to frame this as being in the public interest. And so in that case, he's saying the role of the economist is to have a heightened sense of awareness of not only who benefits, but who loses in the long run and the short run.
I want to get into your dissertation research. The development of political talent, is that your dissertation topic?
No, now it has changed significantly. So my current line of research is on what are called developmental states. So developmental states could also be called state-directed capitalism, but even that kind of hides it. So in a normal liberal economy, you see that in the private sector, businesses are allowed to set their own goals based on the profit loss metric, but the mechanism by which they operate is, you know, controlled by the government. All sorts of regulations on who you can hire, who you can fire, you know, what materials you can use and so on, who you can buy from. And in developmental states, it's sort of the opposite, where the state sets development milestones to reach, you know, we need to have such and such amount of steel production in the country, but the private sector is wholly free to reach that goal however they desire. And so a lot of the countries we think of as capital success stories are more on that model. So South Korea was a developmental state, Taiwan was a developmental state, South Korea, Taiwan, and Singapore were developmental states. The first one was Meiji Japan, between the 1890s and World War II. And then like the third generation developmental states would be countries like Indonesia, countries like, to some extent, Bangladesh, a lot of other South Asian countries, but Indonesia and Bangladesh are probably the two biggest ones. You know, these are the other big growth miracles. And what we saw in those cases was a lot of market liberalization, in the sense that there was a lot less predation and taxation, but you saw a lot more, you know, government having set like exogenous goals for the economy. So the best example of this would be in South Korea. Park Chung-hee, who was a dictator at the time, felt that it was important that South Korea have a significant steel production industry, because he wanted the country to be sovereign arms manufacturing. And very few people wanted to invest in this because South Korea has, too much, if I can remember this right, has generous coal reserves, but not so much generous iron reserves. And so nobody wanted to front up the money. And I think Park Chung-hee ended up diverting money that was used, that was supposed to be reparation for the victims of Japanese imperialism. And he had the government pocket that and start building the steel mill. But he didn't actually have like state-owned industries do this. This was something the private sector did according to profit and loss, but the state was the investor. Often you'll hear socialists say, oh, you know, such and such isn't socialism, it is state capitalism. And in a sense, you could also characterize this kind of behavior as state capitalism, where the state is an investor in certain entrepreneurial goals that are fulfilled almost entirely by the private sector. And so those things, those countries, are what I'm interested in studying. And my dissertation topic focuses also especially on the Syrian Arab Republic. And my argument is that from 2000 to 2011, so the presidential tenure of Bashar, well, Assad is still president right now, but during the undisputed tenure of President Bashar al-Assad, that he was attempting to liberalize Syria based on that developmental state model. But there was a certain loss of state capacity in the transition, which contributed to the Syrian civil war.
Yeah, now I'm seeing why Obama said Assad had to go. It all makes sense.
Actually, it's funny, you know, before that, they were saying, you know, oh, Assad's a great reformer. And they were kind of talking about the fact that Bashar al-Assad was, you know, removing a lot of price controls. He was entering Syria into a lot of regional trade agreements. And on his during his presidential inauguration speech, he said that he wanted to transition Syria into a social market economy. And most people who hear social market economy think it's something like, you know, like Sweden or something, but really he means something like West Germany. But the problem for him, you know, this is now me just advancing my own argument here. You know, the transition from national socialism to the social market economy that we saw in West Germany had an intervening step involving killing a lot of national socialists, banning them from politics, and then holding the entire country at gunpoint under the US Army and the French Army and the British Army, right? Bashar al-Assad's like, we're gonna move from this sort of national socialism to capitalism, but you can't do that when like your entire support base are those self-same socialists, right? It would be like if Hitler made a unilateral decision. I'm not comparing Bashar al-Assad to Hitler. I am in this aspect, actually, right? It would be as if Hitler sort of made a unilateral decision in, let's say, 1933. So in 1942, that, okay, everybody, no more national socialism. Now we're going to prosecute this war with the Soviets using capitalism because capitalism is more productive. So we're getting rid of all these useless parasites that are, you know, attached to German industry. But the thing is, all those useless parasites attached to German industry are like high-ranking National Socialist Party officials. So you have a bit of a problem here.
You have actually made the case against U.S. entry and British entry into the Second World War. How do you justify that position?
Yeah, so World War II delivered almost all of Eastern Europe into the hands of Joseph Stalin. It's a pretty simple case here. America had no national security interest in preserving the British and French colonial empires. It was forced upon it was not even forced upon them. The American people were kind of tricked into it. And so I think that if you look back with an objective eye and you think about, you know, if you think about the political environment in there at the time and looking at the outcomes, looking back, and you don't allow yourself to be sort of enchanted with rhetorical spells about this or that atrocity being carried out by this or that government, you know, World War II, like American entry into World War II was a mistake, right? The world would have been, for all intents, far better off if we allowed Hitler and Stalin to grind each other to death. And then perhaps after that, you know, we can sweep in and then, you know, liberate Poland and Czechoslovakia. But as it is an outcome where, you know, the Bolshevik regime is allowed unchallenged dominion over Ukraine, Belarus, Poland, Hungary, you know, Czechoslovakia, Eastern Germany, Latvia, Estonia, Lithuania, uncountable atrocities. I recently read an article about how after the Bolshevik Revolution, several, like thousands of Cossacks who were anti-Bolshevik fled west and then made it into Germany. They ended up fighting up with the Wehrmacht with the attempt of dislodging the Soviets. And then after the war, the British took these people who had escaped this Bolshevik Revolution and sent them back to Stalin to die. I mean, this is, in my view, like a monstrosity. It's unjustifiable. Right. Obviously, I don't believe that America should be intervening on the side of Hitler to, you know, dislodge the Soviet Union. Like, if we did that, and we were to plunge, you know, Europe, if we were to plunge Poland and Europe and Hungary under the control of Nazis, this too would be a disastrous outcome. But there's no reason for us to intercede on behalf of Joseph Stalin, right? And America was providing, you know, an unforgivable, I mean, even $1 to the Bolshevik regime is unforgivable. Any amount of money to Joseph Stalin is unforgivable. But the amount of American productivity that was diverted towards saving people, you know, who had massacred, you know, the people of Ukraine, the people of St. Petersburg, you know, killed hundreds of thousands of people in a red terror across the country, and said, you know, it is imperative that we prop up this regime against Hitler. No, this regime deserves to fall, right? The Bolshevik regime has to fall, and America should not be intervening to save them. And, you know, England and France are capable, you know, they're big boy countries, right? If they know that America's not going to save them, they can engage in normal politics to get an outcome worthy of them, right? The fall of Paris to the Germans was also a disaster, right? Even though, you know, when we talk about stopping German white supremacy, I mean, the Germans are a white supremacist regime. The French are also a white supremacist regime, right? The British are also a white supremacist regime, right? If you think about the atrocities that England was perpetrating on India and France upon Algeria, the idea that, you know, we were fighting for freedom and democracy, for God's sakes, you know, you had the Dutch government in exile operating out of Indonesia, right? Fighting for freedom and democracy with colonial regiments. No, I don't think so. I don't think that America has any moral imperative or practical imperative to take sides in this kind of struggle between Bolsheviks, Nazis, and the foremost colonial superpowers of the planet.
Yeah, that's a good point. The war for democracy was led by unelected Stalin. Churchill was appointed and never elected. The first time he was up for election, they voted him out. And Roosevelt, not exactly who you'd think of as democratic, you know, yeah, Kidnapping hundreds of thousands of Japanese people and confiscating the nation's gold. So
yeah, another post-war atrocity. Sorry, well, I'm just listing off post-war allied atrocities. You know, during World War II, when Japan was pretending to be a decolonizing force, I had the greater East Asian co-prosperity sphere. First of all, I'm under no illusions that this was actual anti-colonialism. It was a shift from French colonialism to Japanese colonialism, you know, puppet regime set up all out. They were very clear that the Yamato race, as they call themselves, should be the center of this. But you saw the establishment of you know, quasi-independent self-governing institutions in Vietnam, in Laos and Cambodia, as the Japanese swept through. And clearly, these countries were capable of establishing self-governing institutions, even if they weren't the thrall of another. But when the French military reasserted control over Vietnam, they returned it under French colonial administration, making the argument that colonizers like to make, which is that these countries were not ready for self-rule, but they clearly were. There must have been a legion of non-Japanese bureaucrats and activists who were administering the day-to-day operations of Vietnam, but not so according to the French military, who again, you know, brutally reconquered Vietnam. And the result of that we got to see in America again 20 years later.
What is the important difference between someone on the left and someone on the right?
So this is, I go by Paul Gottfried's answer, that to be on the left is to believe in human equality and that inequalities are either artificial or illusory or otherwise ought to be removed or explained away. And to be on the right is to believe that some people are better than others.
How can one be both an anarchist and a capitalist?
I believe in private property as the primary, as that private property should be the primary form of social relation. So people can enforce private property without the state. We see plenty of cases of this happening. I guess if I can just give an example, Pete Leeson uses the case of bush tribes in Angola, who, when the Portuguese showed up on the Angolan coast, there were people and cities on the coast who would go in trade caravans all along the interior for goods like ivory. And when the Portuguese came, they were trading guns to people on the coast for ivory from the interior. And so what you saw at first was an increase in just bandit behavior to satisfy the Portuguese demand. But what the tribals were able to do was to simply threaten to produce only at subsistence. And what there's a cause would be the as these giant raiding caravans would travel into the interior for ivory, you know, you have to spend money on the mercenaries and so on. But if there's nothing to take, there's nothing to take. And so you end up with a whole bunch of, you know, very angry mercenaries wondering where they're going to get paid. And so this is just an example conceptually. So what you ended up seeing, sorry, the second half of this, the social arrangement that resulted was that these caravans would have to pay in advance. So, you know, you'll imagine this caravan of people with guns and mercenaries would show up to a tribe and say, you know, we're going to be back for ivory next week or, you know, 6 months rather. And the tribe says, okay, we have to pay us right now. And it's like, okay, pay you in what? It's like, pay us in alcohol. And then they get all the alcohol and then the tribes would all just drink it like right there in front of them. Right. No refunds. Come back in 6 months. Right. And obviously, you know, the tribes would deliver, but the reason is that so these caravans of raiders couldn't actually, you know, just take the alcohol back when they come back later, something like this. Right. And in this way, in the absence of a state, you had private property protected. Now, obviously, we want to live a slightly more productive and advanced lifestyle than tribes trading ivory for booze with, you know, roving caravans of raiders. But conceptually, we should be able to see that private property protection does not require a monopoly on violence, right?
Final even question. I'm sorry.
Yeah, no, even in the case of massive disparities in force capabilities between one side and another, right, you can still see an agreement in which one side has the ability to alter, transfer, or destroy its property, and the other side does not. And somebody could say, well, wouldn't those raiders be the state then? No, because there's multiple raiders or multiple merchants. They're merchants and raiders, depending on, you know, the time of day, right? There's multiple groups of these people all trading with the Dutch, all going around the same geographic area. And then you might have the same tribe, you know, one caravan comes through, gives them their booze and says, okay, I'll come back 6 months for your ivory. And then another caravan places another order, right? And then they say, well, what if caravan A, you know, chooses, hey, you know, what if we pay you all this booze now and then another caravan comes and robs you? And then the tribe says, well, that's kind of your problem, not ours, right? It'll be our problem when we get robbed, but we don't want that to happen. So it's between the two of you to agree not to rob us. In the meantime, you know, we have some Portuguese wine to finish drinking right now.
Final question, automation destroys jobs. How do you respond?
No, automation does not destroy jobs. Automation creates jobs, but importantly, it does not create jobs, you know, dealing with so sometimes when people say that automation destroys jobs, the sort of libertarian or pro-market response, like, no, because then you'll be able to, you'll get a new job, like maintaining the robots or something, which is like a very rhetorically uncompelling, very not good argument. Automation, to the extent that it's produced for market reasons, right? If automation is produced because it is profitable, right? The point is to lower costs or increase productivity for all of the firms that use that process as an input. So if you automate the production of steel, this presumably makes steel cheaper and therefore makes cars cheaper and so on, and increases the number of cars that can be produced. In that case, anybody who has been put out of work by automation should just go to his boss and say, boss, tell me the names of everybody this firm sells to, right? You've automated me out of a job. So tell me every firm that you guys have contracts with, and then just go door to door and say, hey, listen, I'll let you know the price of what we produce is going to get cheaper. You're going to have a lot of extra money on your hands and you're going to be able to expand your factory. When that factory expansion comes, I want you to know that I'd like a job. Obviously, negotiations will not happen in such a direct fashion, but this is the way we should visualize the economics of automation. You should be going directly downstream of whatever production process is being described. And this is why, you know, people are most afraid of automation of trucks, but I'm like, no, automation of trucks is probably going to be the best thing that ever happens. And, you know, some economic populist is going to be listening and like seething, right? Like, no, think about the tens of millions of truckers who can be put out of work, you know, when these trucks are automated. Like, yeah, but think about literally every business in the world or in the country who faces a significant amount of production costs just waiting for trucks to come through and paying for deliveries, right? Think about all the people they'd be able to hire if they're not dedicating such and such amount towards paying, you know, trucker wages. They're not directly paying trucker wages. They pay a trucking company, right? But, you know, you should be seeking out stable employment with those firms. And in this case, we're talking about almost every firm in the country, one way or another, as we're constantly reminded, every firm in the country is partially reliant on goods delivered by trucks. So
I want to thank everyone for watching the Libertarian Institute and Keith Knight, Don't Tread on Anyone. Mr. Groucho, thank you so much for your time and your excellent answers.
Yep, happy to be here. Thanks for having me.